The following program is furnished by its producer, host, and sponsors. And you're listening to Health and 30 on WRCR AM 1300 Radio Rockland, and it's streaming live at WRCR.com. I'm your host, registered nurse Barbara Ficarra. Health and 30's website is up and running, so check it out. Go to healthand30.com. That's healthin30.com. You can listen to audio, sign up for free newsletters, get all of the information from all of the shows, and more. Don't forget to check it out. Go to healthand30.com. If you have any comments or questions, email us. If any caller out there wants to call in today, call in at 845-624-1300. Today, joining us from San Francisco in California in the Bay Area is Dr. Bruce Wapin. Dr. Wapin is a board-certified emergency physician who trained in general surgery but has spent the last 30 years practicing emergency medicine. He has worked in hospitals as small as 22 beds with a single emergency room all the way up to a level 1 trauma center with a massive emergency department. Currently, he works at Mills Peninsula Hospital in San Francisco. Hi, Dr. Wapin. Thank you so much for joining us. Dr. Wapin? Hello, are you there? Dr. Wapin?
Yes.
Oh, hi, I'm sorry. We couldn't hear you for a second. How are you?
Very good, thank you. How are you?
Oh, good, thanks. Thanks for joining us today.
You're welcome.
How is that out there in California today?
Well, it's fall. I was hoping for an Indian summer, but it didn't happen. We went right from summer into fall.
Pretty chilly over here in New York as well. Dr. Wapin, the emergency room, there's so many issues to cover with that, from what patients can expect to the legal issues involved. Just for the listeners out there, just a brief overview of what they can expect if they happen to go into the ER.
What you can expect is some degree of chaos, just the way emergency departments are. When you first enter the receiving room, the waiting room, what you can expect is that you will be triaged. The word triage means to put you into some level of priority, basically to determine how serious your illness is and how quickly you will need to be seen. You get seen then by a healthcare professional, usually a nurse. Her job is to take a history, do a quick physical examination, get the listing of your medications you're on, your allergies, that sort of thing. Do the vital signs, and then decide on the basis of that information how soon you need to be seen. If it's an ankle sprain or something really not terribly emergent, you might wind up sitting there for an hour or two waiting to be seen while other people with severe abdominal pain, chest pain, or more emergent injuries get seen in front of you, even though they came in after you did.
Right. I just want to back up for a second. You had mentioned when the patient comes in, they'll be triaged usually by a nurse, and she takes a history and they give a list of maybe medications, a past hospitalizations, and a whole history is taken. But can you just go into a little bit more detail exactly what should be involved in that process? Because so many times patients are on so many different medications. Maybe they take vitamin supplements or herbal supplements. Just the importance of really giving a great history to the nurse.
The history, of course, in the emergency department is a focused sort of history, but has to also be a little more expansive. We're concerned initially with your chief complaint. Why are you here? I have chest pain. All right, well, that that puts you in a certain category. And then it will be, well, how long they had the chest pain, and when did it start, and what's the nature of it, and what is the severity on a score of 1 to 10, that sort of stuff. And then what is your past history? Have you had a heart attack in the past? Do you have a history of acid indigestion, which might present as chest pain? Have you had a clot in your leg that might have just thrown a clot to your lung, giving you a pulmonary embolism? And then, of course, the medications that you're on. A lot of people don't know the medications they're on, or they might be on 14, and if they don't have a list in their pocket, they're not going to be able to name them off the top of their head. It becomes rather important for us to know that. 2 o'clock in the morning, what medicines are you on? The person says, well, I don't know, my doctor knows. Oh, that's going to get you really far, 0200. I'm not going to find that information
out. That's just so important, I think, for patients really to know what they're on, and even just if they carry a list with them. So if they do end up in the emergency room, all that information is there to make so they can communicate it to the nurse and the doctor. And
I agree 100%. If you're on a longer list than the average person of medicines, you really should have it written down and carry it with you. And a lot of people do, and we're very appreciative of that. So far as nutritional supplements goes, most doctors really don't care, and we haven't reached the level of sophistication yet where most of us are able to say, oh, because you're on that herb or this vitamin, there might be some interaction or problem. So while it's good to tell it to us, the reality now in this, at the state of medicine right now, is that the information won't do us much good.
So there hasn't been much research then in the area of supplements versus medications?
No, there's been a lot of research done,
but
the average medical doctor doesn't know anything about it.
Well, come on, that's not a good thing.
No, it's not.
All right, so after they go through their health history with the nurse, ideally, you would think patients would go right in and see the doctor or their nurse practitioner, whoever they see in the hospital, at a quick level where they would be seen. But sometimes they could be sitting there for a while, right?
Certainly if their problem is not really emergent,
right,
then they might sit there for a while. If the place is packed and other people with more serious problems are being seen first. If the place is not packed, then it really depends now on the kind of emergency department you're going to, and we need to just talk about that too, at various levels. But if the place isn't packed, the expectation is that you will be triaged and then brought into a room, actually in the inside of the emergency department very quickly, by a nurse. You are put into a room, you'll be asked to undress to at least expose the part that will need to be examined. Vital signs will be repeated, the nurse will make you comfortable. A chart will then be prepared, which includes a whole bunch of demographic information. And that chart will go up onto a rack where you'll be in line to be seen by the medical provider, whether it be a physician, nurse practitioner, or a PA, or a physician assistant. The vast majority, 92% of the time, it's going to be a medical doctor. The other 8% of the time, it'll be one of the ancillary providers.
Now, you mentioned, though, too, it depends on what kind of emergency room, because some you can go to a community hospital. It may not have a large volume. You can go to a large trauma center, and that's totally different. So maybe you could explain a little bit more, too, to the listeners.
Yes. When you're looking, we do level classifications for emergency departments, level 1, 2, 3, 4. Level 1 is what you think of as a trauma center. It's what you see on TV all the time. And you are a level 1 when you are... when you have available 24 hours a day surgery with surgeons in the hospital. They're not on call. They don't have to be coming from home. They're there. And we're talking about not just any old surgeons, but chest surgeon, neurosurgeon, anesthesiologist, ready to take you from the emergency department to the operation, to the operating room as quickly as possible. Those kinds of places tend to be very large medical centers, which usually have teaching facilities, so you'll see medical students and interns and residents there, as well as attendings. And those kind of places may have 6 to 12-hour waits in their waiting room because they are so overwhelmed. That's not unusual. At SF General or Stanford, you can wait forever to be seen. You go into a community hospital such as I work in, we have 15 rooms in our emergency department, not particularly huge. We're quite busy, but you might wait 15 minutes or maybe no time at all, and then you're seen. And when you get in to be seen, you're usually seen within an hour by the physician who's running around like crazy, seeing everybody as quickly as he can. If you go to a small, so that we're level 2, somebody is on call in all of the specialties within a half hour of time to come into the hospital. Level 3 is not so good. Maybe people are on call, maybe they're not. And level 4 gets to where nobody's on call, and you're in a small hospital, a 25-bed hospital, where likely is if you've got a serious problem, you're going to be transferred out. Also likely, you'll be seen right away in a small hospital. So if your problem is not severe, that might be the ideal place to go.
So typically, what should patients look out for? If they, we'll use the example of a community hospital. If a patient goes there, say for abdominal pain, what should they expect? How long do you think they should be waiting in the emergency room until they see a physician or...
Sure. You shouldn't really be waiting more than... Once you get in the emergency department from the triage area, you shouldn't wait more than an hour to actually be seen by the emergency physician. Emergency physician then should do a rather comprehensive history and physical, which means asking a lot of questions you might not think are germane to your problem, like, you know, what kind of medical problems did your parents have, and are you a smoker, and all kinds of stuff that we really need to know and put in the medical record. And then a thorough physical examination will be done, and tests will be ordered. And those tests might be quite comprehensive, as in blood tests, chest x-ray, EKG, CT scan of the abdomen. Therein lies one of the problems. The obtaining of the specimens and then the processing of those may take quite a while. It may take an hour, 2 hours before those results come back, during which time you're likely to be treated. An intravenous line may be started. You may be given medicines for pain if that is your primary presenting complaint. If you're in there, let's say you're short of breath and maybe you're congestive heart failure, you might get medications that will relieve those symptoms. Waiting for the ultimate test to come back, which then give as definitive a diagnosis to us as we're likely to obtain in that brief window of opportunity. And so maybe you'll be in the emergency department 3 hours, during which time you will have been examined, you will be treated, lots of tests will be done, and we'll have arrived at some reasonable diagnostic impression. And at that point, the decision is made, do you get admitted or do you get to go home?
Now, if someone is a patient in a large trauma center and they're in the emergency room area, they already went through triage, they're waiting in the room, but it's just so chaotic, so busy, so much is going on. And what can a patient say to one of the nurses or the doctor? What can they say to get themselves seen? You know, how can they speak up in a way that's not going to make them sound as if they're complaining or an irate type of patient, but what can they say for them to feel more comfortable so they know what's going on and that they will be treated? And because sometimes, you know, just waiting is the hardest part. So
it is the hardest part. Well, first off, always bring a good book when you come to the emergency department and make it a thick one.
Tip number one, bring a good book.
One.
Okay, that's good.
A lot of emergency departments are now putting TV sets in each of the rooms to sort of take the pressure off. You've got something else to do.
Right.
But we find people, they're standing at the door of their room with their arms folded, tapping their foot.
Right.
We're seeing people as fast as we can go. Seriously, when I'm at work, I see people as fast as I can run. I don't write on charts. At the end of my 8-hour shift, I've got a stack of charts that I spend 3 additional hours filling out because I don't have the time to write on them. I'm seeing patients as rapidly as I can. Even so, there's a wait. Well, if somebody comes in my face and says, hey, you're going to see me right now, what's the point? I'm already seeing everybody as fast as I can, and you're in some line to be seen. Your chart's up on the wall. Obviously, if you code, and I'm going to run right in that room, or if there's a code blue up on the floor, mm-hmm. I get distracted. But it doesn't really help to say, I want to be seen now and be demanding.
Right.
We're doing it as fast as we can. People kind of think in terms of private offices where you have an appointment and, hey, I was here at 6. I'm supposed to be seen at 6. No. It doesn't work that way.
Exactly. I guess that's the message kind of that I want to get out, though, too, to people, that although it is an emergency room and everyone will be seen, it may not be within that, you know, 5-10 minutes that they're there, that there is some waiting period. And
yes.
So I think that's important for people to know. But bring a good book. That's a good thing.
Absolutely, bring a good book.
What else should for the listeners out there, maybe who's never been to an emergency room and it's their first time and they went through the whole process and they're going to be admitted now, how long is the wait usually from the time that they're in the emergency room to the time they get up to the floor?
Well,
I mean, that can definitely vary, too.
One of the huge problems in emergency medicine, and that is, we have in the emergency department really no control over how long it takes to get admitted. That's got to do with how many beds are available and whether there's nursing staff available upstairs to accept you. And so one of the huge issues in emergency medicine is, besides overcrowding and boarding, I mean, it's absolutely insane, but sometimes the hospital has no beds, and so they board people in the emergency department. You may be in the emergency department at the general for 48 hours and
right.
never get upstairs. Well, that means if you're there, someone else who comes in to be seen can't be seen. You're taking up that room, even though your emergency care is done with. That's insane. So there's now legislation going on to try to ameliorate this problem, but of course it's all about money. You know, what are the incentives monetarily to open more beds, to have more nurses, to move things along more quickly, and hopefully it can be addressed adequately. In my particular hospital, and in most smaller hospitals, this is a problem for the big hospitals. This is a problem for the big center city trauma centers. For the smaller community hospitals, it's not yet as big a problem, but it's becoming a crisis. And so we can never say how long it's going to take to get upstairs. We do it as fast as we can, mm-hmm. and it's to our advantage to do that. We need the space. We don't want to be taking care of people whom we've already finished up with. So people say, well, why am I still down here? Hey, we're doing the best we can to get you out of here. The problem is upstairs, not
downstairs. How what's the nursing situation like there? Do you have a shortage in your hospital that you're at?
We do, not as severe as mm-hmm. it was. My hospital is owned by a chain of 23 hospitals. They've got some bucks. They went over to the Philippines and recruited hundreds of nurses from the Philippines to come over here to work in the chain of hospitals that I work with. And that has been successful. It's just a little disconcerting to see that now we have so many foreigners providing the services, which used to be provided by, you know, Native Americans.
Well, but here's okay. my... Oh, I'm sorry. I don't mean to interrupt you. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, here's my take on the whole nursing thing, being that I actually am a nurse. I think it's... I mean, there's so many issues, actually, really, why there's a shortage of nursing, and even actually a shortage of the professors out there teaching the nurses. The way the media portrays nurses, too, it's not at the level of that it should be. I mean, we are professionals, and I don't think that's yet portrayed in the media as such. Even when you watch some of these medical dramas, too, it's always physician-based, and nurses are... If we're lucky if we're in the background on some of these shows.
I agree. And so then who would opt to go into nursing
right.
when, in fact, it doesn't seem that glorious a profession to be in?
Right.
The reality is, well, in the emergency department, I should stay with that since that's my area of expertise.
Mm-hmm.
The emergency department nurses love it, although there is a high degree of burnout. It's a very challenging
yes.
job,
mm-hmm.
but it's a fun job. We have a great time, and we're a team, too. It's one of the few places in the hospital where you really work as a team. You do in the operating room, that's a team situation, and you do in the emergency department, the
mm-hmm.
doctor and the nurses and the x-ray techs and all, we're a big team, including the paramedics and the other people who are part of the EMS system. Up on the floors, that isn't so much the case. The nurses take care of the patients, the doctor shows up maybe twice a day, writes some orders and leaves. It's not really a very big team effort.
That's good, though, that what you said, because that's so important to show that nurses and physicians are working together. It's not physician at one level, nurses at a lower level.
Oh, no.
You know, it's equal, and your healthcare professional is providing care for the patient, and that's the bottom
yeah,
line. So I'm glad you said that.
In the emergency department, the physicians are absolutely dependent upon the skills and the knowledge of the nursing staff. We depend on the nurses, to give all the medicines accurately that we prescribed or asked for in the emergency department, and also to give us an update if somebody starts going south on us, and we're in a room far away. We need to have them come and get us and say, come and look at the patient, he's not doing well, which means they have to realize what signs and symptoms indicate you're not
right,
doing
exactly,
well.
Exactly, right.
Yeah, it's very important.
Yep. Well, thank you for that. All right, let's move on to the legal issues now that you mentioned a little bit before about the crisis and I guess there's specific bills that are now in progress trying to get more funding for the emergency rooms.
Yeah, there are a couple of big issues. There is a law, which nobody knows about except those who are stuck with it, called the EMTALA law, Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act, enacted back in 1986. And it's a good law. I mean, it addresses this reality which used to be, a person would come to the window and say, I've got a medical problem. And the question they used to ask instead of, do you need to see a doctor and then triage, they would say, do you have insurance? They would say, no. Do you live in the county? Yes. Go to the county hospital. And they would throw you out. Well, people died en route to the county hospital. Babies were born in cars. I mean, all kinds of weird things happened. And so the federal government said that won't do. We're now going to make a law saying you may not turn anybody away. When they come in, they must be seen and they must be stabilized. And stabilization of that patient prior to discharge requires you to use every facility within that hospital, every test, every specialist, in order to determine that the patient is stable or else you can't discharge them, right? So So that said, boom, they're there. So the law says you've got to see them all, but the law didn't give any money for it. Now you have a bunch of people coming in with, let's say, no money in places where there is, let's say, a high element of people from other countries who maybe don't speak the language, don't have any money, don't have any insurance. You take care of them anyway. So we do lots of uncompensated care. And I do mean uncompensated. That's just the way it is because the law says you must see them, but the law says we don't give you any money for it. Well, what has that resulted in? It's resulted in crowding in the emergency department. Those same people can't get primary care physicians, so they use the emergency department as their safety net for primary care. That then leads to another problem, which is when you call on a specialist, a broken leg, you call up the orthopedic surgeon, he says, does the patient have any insurance? No. Well, what's the incentive for him to take care of that patient? And yet he's on call. So they're saying nowadays, used to be, they had the feeling they would be on call and they would support the hospital. Nowadays they say, you know what, I'm not going to be on call anymore. You can't reach me. Send him someplace else. Oh, that's a real problem. Now they're in the emergency department. I've got to take care of them. We've got to take care of them, but there's no specialist who wants to take care of them. Find somebody who will. All right, so there are laws now being put before both the House of Representatives and the Senate, which address this issue. And they're doing it in kind of an interesting way. They're saying since the federal government enacted this law that we must see everybody, which is a good law, and the federal government should also now pass a law which says that they will be responsible for paying more money to those doctors who are not getting compensation for their care, and from the liability aspect, in case we get sued, which happens with great regularity, it will go to the federal government to defend us, as opposed to our own private insurance policy. Because you get into a medical malpractice insurance, it's gone out the roof, and a lot of people even can't get insurance. People were leaving states. West Virginia recently had a super problem with that, where doctors were leaving the state in droves because they couldn't get insurance. And Florida, too, and Pennsylvania also. California hasn't had that big a problem because we've got a law that kind of covers that. So, anyway, the federal government is now going to have to look at this issue. Why? Why? Because emergency medical services are essential to the society. And so instead of just being, oh, some private concern and those rich doctors, what the heck, you know, we don't need to support them, it's, hey, this is a societal issue. If we have, we're all concerned about terrorism. If bombs go off, people are going to flock and their two emergency departments are going to use the emergency system. They consider it there. It's supposed to be there, right?
And do you think they're in place, the emergency rooms for these?
Well, they are in place. They're already overwhelmed.
Right.
We're in crisis now.
Mm-hmm.
Drop a few bombs in key metropolitan areas, instant overwhelming.
Mm-hmm.
Can't meet the need.
So, let me just reiterate what you just said. In a couple words.
You know, Barbara.
Yeah.
I'm from Philadelphia originally, so
right.
You notice I speak rather rapidly. But you
no, that's okay. I just want to make sure I understand and the listeners understand. So the law is to treat all patients, which is a good law because all people should deserve care. No, there's not one person who shouldn't. People are people. Everyone deserves
correct.
Care. That's
yes.
Perfectly fine. But did you say though that the specialists who come in do not want to treat them because they're not getting compensated? Is that right?
Yeah, who would? It's about money, right? And
okay.
If they're not compensated, they don't have any big obligation to see people for nothing.
So then it's turning to the government now to fund all the hospitals so everyone can get the appropriate care.
Yes.
Now, where is this in legislation? Is it? It's how far do you think it's going to take for this to happen?
It's not terribly far. The organization to which I belong, my parent group, is the American College of Emergency Physicians.
Mm-hmm.
And I just chatted with their legal liaison officer before this conversation,
mm-hmm.
so I would know what I'm talking about. and she said, yeah, you know, we've got 50 co-sponsors for the House of Representatives bill and 5 co-sponsors for the Senate bill. Well, you know, that's a long way to go. And that's just to bring it up to the floor to try and get a vote on it. Then it has to go to the executive branch, and, you know, and they hopefully not get vetoed. So there's a long way to go.
Let me just back up for one quick second. When you said that the physicians won't treat them, are there a lot of lawsuits then happening because of that? Because they're not being treated the way that maybe they should be? I mean, I don't know if you can answer that.
It's not being treated the way you should be. It's a matter of whether you get treated at all or who's going to do the treating.
Right.
So it falls back on me then as the emergency physician. I'm the only doctor who's seen the patient. All right, so I've got a person with a severe fracture who has no money and no local address.
So an orthopedist won't go to see the patient?
Well, in my hospital they will, but let's say I worked at a hospital where they wouldn't.
Okay, where they would.
There's nobody on call, period. You know, you make a few phone calls and there's nobody. All right, now I have to call around to other hospitals in the area who have somebody on call who will be willing to accept this person in transfer. Well, that may take me 4 or 5 hours to get that arranged.
They have to transfer the patient out to another hospital?
I'm speaking in general. Now,
right.
Now, in my hospital, that's why I work in my hospital. That doesn't happen where I work. I've worked in 20 different hospitals in my 30-year career, and I've been in places where this is a problem, and now I'm in a place where this isn't a problem. And you know what? One of the big problems in emergency medicine is burnout. You're working in this chaos with screaming people, and everybody's in pain. What brings you to the emergency department? Pain brings you to the emergency department. And you're being pulled four ways to Sunday by the nurses because of this patient is critical and that one's critical. And at the end of the day, you're all beat up. And what if you can't get support from the other doctors on the staff who have to take over when you've reached the end of your capabilities, if the person needs to go to surgery, I don't go into surgery with the patient. I stay in the emergency department. Well, when you get to a point where you don't get support, then you start burning out because it becomes too laborious a job to do anymore. And you say, I'm out of here. I don't need this anymore. It's just too hard. Well, so I've gravitated to a hospital where that isn't the problem. I love going to work. I get a buzz out of it. And all the doctors on staff with me are very collegial.
Right.
So when I call them up, and the cardiologist, he says, I'll be right in and take care of your heart attack. I call the orthopedic surgeon, I'll be right in, no problem at all. That isn't the usual scenario.
That's the way it should be.
That's the way it should be.
Now, in the hospital where that's not happening, though, do you know if the patients or families are speaking up, saying, you know, that why aren't they having an orthopedist come? Or, I mean, can they almost demand that or no? It's because of the system.
No. All they can say is, I need care, and they say to them, we will get you care, but it won't be here.
Okay, I think we need healthcare professionals in the Senate and Congress and. It doesn't make any sense. Everyone deserves to have care,
But see, that's a kind of a paradigm shift.
Yeah.
That isn't necessarily that. Oh, that's socialized medicine. What are you talking about? This is America, you know? All right, well, hey, at some level, it is socialized, and it needs to be. If you're going to consider this a basic right in this country to get medical care when you need it, then and you don't have the money to pay for it, well, then it's got to come out of the government. That's socialized. And at some level, that has to be the way it is. And I think at emergency medicine level, it has to be that way.
Well, I hope things change because I truly can't imagine a patient going into an emergency room and then being, you know, that's stressful in and of itself, and then to be transferred to another hospital trying to get the care, that's just not right. I hope this turns around somehow. Now, you said you just spoke to somebody the emergency, American College of Emergency Physicians? Is that who you said?
Yes.
And so that you don't see it happening. What's the time frame? Did she give you, a certain... I know you said it's not any...
Well, this legislation is the beginning of the realization that this safety net is crumbling, and when it crumbles, we're really in trouble. What it may, and this legislation will probably take a year or so to enact and make, it will make a difference. It won't be the huge difference. What will probably make a huge difference is if we have some true disaster, a bombing or whatever, and people try to get emergency care and find out just how inadequate the emergency response is, the numbers of hospitals in their area to handle a true big emergency.
And that's always the way, though, right? Wait for something to happen, and then they change things. Instead of doing it the preventative way, the way it should be.
It requires a crisis first, and then, oh, my gosh, let's fix that.
Right. Dr. Wapen, thank you so much. I cannot believe a half hour is up already.
Oh, I can't even.
But thank you so much for your expertise, your time, and everything else. I truly, greatly appreciate it.
Well, you're very welcome. It was my pleasure. Oh,
thanks. Take care.
Thank you.
And that wraps it up for today. That was Dr. Bruce Wapen from San Francisco, from Mills Peninsula Hospital. Stay tuned for next week. Joining us is Dr. Robin Miller from Medford, Oregon. We'll talk about integrative medicine. She has trained with the world-renowned Dr. Andrew Weil. And that wraps it up for today. I'm Barbara Ficarra for Health in 30. Have a great week.
AM 1300, WRCR, Spring Valley.
USA Radio Network News, Dennis Martin reporting. The UN Security Council today told North Korea to abandon its planned nuclear test or face unspecified consequences. America's UN ambassador says the members want to make very clear to North Korea what's at stake.
The main point is that North Korea should understand how strongly the United States and many other council members feel that they should not test this nuclear device, and that if they do test it, it will be a very different world the day after the test.
At the White House, spokeswoman Dana Perino says the U.S. and its allies continue to focus on diplomatic persuasion.
One thing is for sure is that we will be continuing to work with our partners in the region, using our influence to the greatest extent possible, as well as those of our partners in the other five of the six parties. Talks.
There are reports North Korea could conduct a nuclear test this weekend. Thousands of residents remain out of their homes, and more than a dozen emergency personnel had to be treated for chemical exposure caused by an explosion and fire at a hazardous waste plant in Apex, North Carolina. The mayor says no one's going home until hazardous materials experts are sure it's safe. On Wall Street, the Dow fell more than 16 points to 11,850. NASDAQ dropped 6 points today to 2299. USA Radio Network News.
Alrighty, a short paragraph about myself. I was born on a rainy night some 35 years ago aboard Father's schooner in stormy seas.
Having trouble creating a profile online that is going to attract the attention of your soulmate? How about doing it a different way? How about falling in love from the inside out? At eHarmony.com, you don't have to come up with witty one-liners that distill your life into a paragraph.
Page 4. As a small child, I enjoyed sitting on grandfather's knee while he whittled small woodland creatures out of driftwood and ate prunes.
At eHarmony.com, our scientific compatibility profile does the work for you by matching you based on 29 inside dimensions of compatibility proven to be crucial for a great relationship. Visit eHarmony today and start the ball rolling with your $50 compatibility profile, yours free when you visit eHarmony today.
President Bush spent a little time today giving his administration credit for the state of the U.S. economy.
President Bush said the national unemployment rate is down to 4.6%. We've added 6.6 million new jobs since August of 2003. He said the wages are going up, energy prices are falling, and this means people are going to have more money in their pocket to save, invest, or spend. He said we can be certain to sustain the economic growth by making the tax cuts that we passed permanent. Connie Lawn, USA Radio Network News, the White House.
Also today, in a White House ceremony celebrating Hispanic Heritage Month, President Bush described Hispanics as hard-working people and noted that Hispanic-owned businesses are growing at 3 times the national rate. The 5th victim of Monday's Amish schoolhouse shooting was buried today in Nickel Mines, Pennsylvania. 4 others buried yesterday. USA Radio Network News.
And I'm Blaise Gomez with your local news here on WRCR AM 1300 Radio Rockland. The Steps to a Healthier New York 2nd Annual Tasty and Healthy Pizza Contest will be held this Monday, October 9th from 1 to 4 p.m. at Banchetto Feast Restaurant in the Nanuet Mall. Over 20 restaurants will compete to be named as having the healthiest, tastiest pizza in Rockland. A panel of judges will select winners in categories including best thin crust pie, most creative pizza, and healthiest toppings. The public is invited to taste the competing pies at no cost and cast a ballot for their favorite healthy pizza restaurant. For more information on the Steps to a Healthier New York program, call 845-364-2500. With debit card fraud on the rise, Senator Hillary Clinton announced today that she has introduced a measure to provide consumer protection similar to those for credit cards. Endorsed by the Consumers Union, the Debit and Check Card Consumer Protection Act of 2006 would allow the holder of a fraudulently used debit card to be held unaccountable for charges of more than $50, regardless of when the fraud is reported. It would also provide consumers unsatisfied with the transaction greater than $50 the right to contact the debit card issuer and charge back the transaction payment to the merchant. Current debit and check cards.